This episode is brought to you by Future Hindsight, a podcast on civic engagement. Their current season focuses on the ways we can work together to rebuild a better America from the pandemic. And this week, they look at workers in the gig economy and how app-based labor platform companies have proliferated unprotected work. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com. Start the show.
With Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at the New Republic, Alex Perrine will join us to take a breath, look back on this election and its resolution, and look forward as to what is coming next. We do this on the eve of Thanksgiving. And at a time where the country is engulfed in a pandemic with a significant and unfortunate portion of the country that seems to discount the very existence of this pandemic in many respects, and in some really horrible respects, it is the cat's out of the, what is it? The cow's out of the barn at this point. Joining me, of course, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm good, Sam. How are you? I wholeheartedly agree that the continued discounting of the pandemic is troubling. We are seeing mass travel on Thanksgiving against the recommendation of CDC guidelines. So that's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, it's incredibly unfortunate. And in some respects, you know, it is, I don't know. I want to say it's understandable. And part of it is because, I mean, look, I like to think that maybe people have, sort of picked up something from the news reporting about the existence of this COVID. But there has been a concerted effort for months to downplay this entire pandemic. Yesterday, Donald Trump got up in front of the Washington press pool. My understanding is it was a surprise press conference. In other instances, we might play it for you. I don't know, Brendan, Matt, do we have that? I mean,
it was seemingly pointless.
Well,
yes.
But I mean, that's the thing that was sort of shocking about it. He walked up onto the podium. He said hello. One would have anticipated that on a day where you have near records number of people infected in this country, a growing number of people dying in this country, you have multiple states, municipalities, locales that are dealing with hospitals that are being overrun, you would anticipate that he would come out and address this pandemic.
Well, you would anticipate that a president would do that. Would you anticipate that Donald Trump would do that? I think not.
Touche. Let's take a look at this. This is one of those opportunities where we can play the whole press conference and not have to worry about it because it was that ridiculously short. Let's play this.
Good Well, thank you very much. And I just want to congratulate everybody. The stock market, Dow Jones Industrial Average, just hit 30,000, which is the highest in history. We've never broken 30,000. And that's just despite everything that's taken place with the pandemic. I'm very thrilled with what's happened on the vaccine front. That's been absolutely incredible. It's nothing like that has ever happened medically. And I think people are acknowledging that. And it's having a big effect. But the stock market's just broken 30,000. Never been broken, that number. That's a sacred number, 30,000. Nobody thought they'd ever see it. That's the ninth time since the beginning of 2020. And it's the 48th time that we've broken records in during the Trump administration. And I just want to congratulate all the people within the administration that worked so hard. And most importantly, I want to congratulate the people of our country, because there are no people like you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
There it is.
A sacred number. You know, I think that's why Mike Pence was there, right? To vouch for the religious nature of the stock market hitting 30,000. Is that what he said?
Sacred number.
Yes, it's biblical. And Jesus said all of these things, you know, that this was a sign.
Of course. You can find this very much in the Bible, that 30,000 is the... But here's the real question. What was it that brought it to 30,000, to this sacred number? Well, I think it coincidentally... just happened to happen within hours after Joe Biden had been received the transition funds. And it was quite clear that Joe Biden was becoming the president elect without any controversy. And the other, you know, thing that I found just sort of stunning about this was not only the fact that he clearly, the whole theory here was, this is going to be my legacy, that it gets to 30,000. And even in the course of that, like, the guy does not even mention the fact that as of yesterday, when he came out there, well, I should say on November 23rd, there was 180,000 new cases of infection. There was over 1,000 people who were dead. There was over 85,000 who were hospitalized. The number obviously up today and in going forward, this is what we're going to be expecting. And who knows what's going to happen with Thanksgiving? Mentions nothing about that. I mean, contemplate, 1,000 people died on the day that he is mentioning this, and not a single word about it. However, he does mention the vaccine, but he doesn't even like associate it with the government doing anything about it. I mean, on some level, he wants it just to be that he is just the magical elixir, that these things happen. I think he was just literally thinking, like, I want a 1 minute video that can be replayed for years from now, so that this announcement that I could make of it, of the stock market going over 30,000, we can replay that on social media. I mean, that is how narrow this guy's worldview is.
Well, he thinks in terms of sound bites. He thinks in terms of media. We always talk about this, about how he is always in PR mode. So everything comes from a marketing perspective of how can I make myself appear? How can I spin certain actions? How can I spin mass COVID deaths to make myself look a certain way? I mean, yeah, the fact that he didn't acknowledge the COVID deaths says everything. But also, like, is there no introspection that the stock market is completely now disconnected from the economic realities of regular people? I mean, I know that's asking way too much, because even the Democrats don't participate in that kind of thinking at a mass level. But the fact that it's breaking records should indicate to you, as there are tens of millions of Americans on unemployment insurance, and 12 million of them could lose it after Christmas, and there's an eviction crisis looming, a homelessness crisis looming, the economy's in an economic depression. Like, maybe this isn't the best indicator of the success of the economy.
Yes.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, the way that the stock market is completely untethered from the lives of tens of, really, I mean, very specifically, hundreds of millions of Americans. But at this moment, the idea that the stock market has no bearing, it's fascinating. And a Democratic Party that was actively seeking to hinder the brand of its opposition party so that they could win elections up and down a ticket where they wouldn't have to rely on Donald Trump as some type of anomaly, but rather could reference Donald Trump as an avatar for the Republican Party, would point out specifically the idea that not only is it grotesque that he doesn't mention what's going on with the pandemic, he doesn't even say have a happy Thanksgiving. It's doubly grotesque because there's something fundamentally wrong where you have, and we know that 20% of the population owns something like 80% of the stocks, where,
and half of Americans don't have any investment in it at all.
And such a narrow group of people are doing so extraordinarily well on the cusp, like you say, of a massive, massive economic disruption with the potential to immiserate tens of millions of people is shocking. And we will talk to Alex Perrin a little bit about this undoubtedly, but I continue to feel that the Democrats missed an opportunity, not just in the context of the election, but in context of the past 2 years, when they had at the very least the power of the House to make sure that when people see Donald Trump, they see the Republican Party. That was a missed opportunity.
Emblematic in the candidate that they ran or chose, who basically talked about Trump as if he was a fever dream, not the accumulation of decades of policies by the Republicans, but said basically, oh, you know, this is not who we are. That's what his whole
brand was. And I got to say, you know, from it worked for Joe Biden. But politicians need to have like a certain amount of, well, first off, Biden
ran on that.
You can
have a strategy that doesn't just help you. You can have a strategy that helps your party.
I don't fault Joe Biden for running the best Joe Biden campaign that he could run. But I guess the point I'm making is that Democrats had 2 years when they controlled the House where they could build this narrative that would not have conflicted with Joe Biden's necessarily, and didn't have to. It could have existed alongside it, and they didn't take that opportunity. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perrin. We will talk about this and where we go from here as we prepare for our Thanksgiving, our little mini vacation, where we will have turkey and hopefully not travel very far and not do it with a lot of people. Back in just a moment. We are back. Joining us now via Zoom is Alex Perrin. He is the staff writer, a staff writer from the New Republic. In my mind, the staff writer, and also the co-host of the Politics of Everything, the New Republic podcast. Alex, good to see you here with Emma Vigeland. I see that you're getting into, you can't necessarily travel home, but you're going to just sort of bring home to you with the twins hat. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. I'm there in spirit.
I was about to remark on the hat. It's a cool one. I wish I could pull off hats on the, as a woman on TV or on the internet, but like, I don't necessarily.
You should give it a try. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe with the flannel, it might be a little too much cosplay. But
no, Emma, whatever fashion choices you want to make are okay here at the Majority Report. Trust me.
Yes. I try and set the tone by making the bar so low in terms of what constitutes good fashion that that anybody can get away with wearing anything. So, Alex, it's a good time to sort of take a step back. Joe Biden is now officially the president-elect, or at least I should say that there's no, there seems to be, to the extent that there's any controversy about that statement, it seems to reside in about one or two people who have an official capacity in our government. Right. And I think that's, maybe it's just Donald Trump. And we're also getting a sense of how Joe Biden is staffing stuff. But I want to start, you've written a couple of pieces over the past week or two that I want to touch on. And one was one that you wrote about 12 days ago. A coup is a coup. And I think this is, I think it's important, despite the fact that it seems that the concerted effort to maintain power by Donald Trump has all but ended.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that we have, we characterize what took place as that we're accurate in the way that we characterize it, because it's a distant memory, but it also has sort of like provided some muscle memory, I'm afraid, for yeah. our system that may be deployed in the future. I mean, just talk about this idea, because, you know, people were sort of laughing, you know, I laughed when Rudy Giuliani was sweating his hair dye down both sides of his face, and when they had to jettison Sidney Powell because she was talking lunacy. But there were some other parts that were very, very scary about it, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to take hindsight to see the extent to which ridiculousness has been used as a shield by this administration, in a sense. Like, the fact that things are ridiculous means that their very real efforts to do these things can be laughed at instead of appreciated seriously. And
it's almost a defense mechanism. I'll just point that out too, by, I feel like, the public, where that it's so ridiculous that you almost have to laugh at it, because to truly reckon with the horror would be a little bit difficult to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when it's sort of treated as, or when it is genuinely silly and incompetent, that almost makes it seem less like it almost seems to make the intent not matter, but the intent was there. And I think with the coup conversation, you know, people picture tanks on the streets. The United States is not the sort of country where the military is going to do that in this environment, obviously. And if you wanted to get technical, if people are sort of objecting to the use of the word coup, you know, it was closer to a self coup, which is basically when someone already in power stays in power by extra legal means, sometimes dismissing the legislature or whatever. That was the attempt just now. It was just literally what the attempt was. I think you are right that it was testing how many people were comfortable with pursuing that and how many people were comfortable with letting it happen.
Well, that is the thing that really that strikes me. And I would just, you know, when in 2000, when we were talking about the Supreme Court, which did something that I can tell you at the time, no one in the legal institution expected the Supreme Court to take that case in 2000. I mean, no one. You go back, read what people are reading contemporaneously, read what commentators were saying. No one anticipated the Supreme Court taking that case because of the nature of the Florida Supreme Court deals with its own elections. And there were people who were saying, like, this is, in many respects, a coup. You have a small cabal yeah. of people who have decided the trajectory of an election. What is different this time is what you just pointed out, was who was willing to go along with it. You know, we had every single, particularly for the first week, right?
Yeah.
Every single elected Republican official, and even down to the last days, the only elected officials you would see who would say anything were people who were retiring,
right?
You know, like Toomey. And we had every Republican elected official who's speaking, basically say, we need to see how this plays out.
Right.
And, you know, there were people, like, I criticized Chris Coons for doing this. Dick Durbin did this in some sense. And there was reporters doing this. Well, in private, some of these guys say it's not, we realize this is just for Donald Trump's sake, but if the margins were smaller.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Who knows how that goes, right?
If this had all come down to if Wisconsin was a tipping point state and it was close margins, I think they would have just gone for it. I mean, I think they would have just done it, and I think they would have been successful.
And I have no doubt that the Supreme Court, in the same way that it did in Bush v. Gore, would have thrown out ballots that didn't meet the very specific standards met by, say, Wisconsin, met by, say, Pennsylvania, whatever state it came down to. I mean, we did come incredibly close. And I think it also dovetails nicely with what Sam and I have been talking about for a while, which is that the failure of the Democrats to connect Donald Trump to the Republican Party and the Republican brand, like, that's what makes it even more dangerous, because the Republican brand, the members of this party, were the very ones who went along with this and who also participated in Bush v. Gore and everything that went down in 2000. So that's extremely important, because when you set up this blueprint and you let the Republican Party off the hook, that blueprint can be used by the very Republican Party that backed this narrative this time around.
And I will say, you know, if it comes down to Wisconsin, it never gets to the Supreme Court, because you have a conservative state Supreme Court there.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
All the Supreme Court needs to do is to just simply not take the case at that point. I mean, I think, you know, which state it came out of and what was the disposition of the state Supreme Court would have been determinative as to whether the U.S. Supreme Court would have gotten involved. But I mean, how is it that, and like Emma says, you know, one of my hobby horses, and I think, you know, we'll talk a little bit about this, has been the failure of the Democrats to tie Donald Trump to the Republican Party. Forget about just in the context of the election season, but on day one of taking the House. And frankly, you can go back and there are WikiLeaks emails that the Clinton campaign was specifically running in such a way to protect Paul Ryan and separate him.
Yeah.
The strategy being there are good Republicans and then there's Donald Trump, which obviously failed. And it also led to down ballot failures as well.
Yep.
In this election. But you had no, like, even as we watch this, our opposition party is not calling out these Republicans. I mean, Bernstein the other day, Carl Bernstein named names for the first time. And on some level, I mean, I applaud him for doing that. That should have happened. Like, it's, you make people pay a price,
right?
A political price one way or another.
Yeah.
Where is that instinct in Democratic politicians?
I have no idea. And especially at this point, I have no idea. And I think it's obviously something that they're not comfortable running against Republicans they're just unwilling to, like, paint the Republican Party as the problem, right? Perfectly willing to say Trump is the issue. But I don't know. I just think that maybe just the optimistic pursuit of longtime Republican voters led them to be like, well, you know, we can't say that you were wrong to have been voting for Paul Ryan this whole time. But I think that, you know, the specific way that it leads Democrats astray is that the sort of Republicans they embrace are not even very well liked or popular, you know,
it's kowtowing to their aggressiveness, to the Republicans' aggressiveness. It's fear of retaliation for doing politics and reacting to Republicans.
I think Democrats just, like, they look at polls that say Americans don't like it when there's partisan bickering. I think it's really as simple as, like, these polls say people don't like it when there's partisan bickering. So we cannot be perceived as doing politics. And that, I think what it sort of misunderstands is that the partisan bickering is, a result of Republicans having too much power.
Right. Do you remember, and this is a maybe a 15-year-old reference, but Josh Marshall had this theory during the Bush administration of, you know, rhymes with witch slap politics. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that one of the things that that Republicans began to do at that time was they were openly overt about trying to sort of just dominate Republican, I mean, Democrats in this way. I mean, just do stuff like go up and punch them right in the face for seemingly no reason. And the, you know, the theory that that Josh Marshall had was that when Democrats don't strike back, what they're communicating is not that they're looking for, you know, some type of, you know, compromise or work out. What they're communicating is they can't be relied on to even protect themselves, never mind protect you. Right. And I think we are still mired in that, in that mindset. What's interesting to me is that I'm quite convinced it's generational, right? Yeah. Like it's not, you know, we had, you know, we see folks like the Squad get much more aggressive in a partisan fashion, in a partisan fashion.
Yeah.
They happen to have an ideology, I think, that is to the left of the center of the Democratic Party. But you can look to like Michigan, like Whitmer and Dana Nessel, who I think is the attorney general there. And they are extremely aggressive fighters. They aren't necessarily
lefties. Yeah.
They aren't necessarily lefties at all. But they are, you know, and I think at one point Whitmer learned the lesson, like there was no value in her trying to make peace with these people. She's doubled down on those people who were like, you know, charging the state capitol. Nessel, I think, was like threatening charges against the canvassers who were, you know, basically refusing to certify the vote at one point, or they kept switching back and forth. These are very aggressive tactics. And I think it shows that you can be aggressive. Doesn't necessarily have to be an ideological thing. Like there
absolutely doesn't have to be. Yeah.
Baseline problem with the Democrats in that way.
It's funny. Like, yeah, you say like you identify this thing Josh Marshall was writing about 15 years ago. And I think it's generational. And it also happens to be true that the people who were in charge of the National Congressional Democratic Party 15 years ago are happen to be the same people in charge of it now.
It's stunning. It's stunning.
And you know, I think it's completely, it is often treated as an ideological dispute. You know, the hard left wants the Democrats to do this, but it is not. And I think that even, you know, all of the Pod Save America guys would agree with you completely, right? Like that this is their case too. Like it is a matter of like partisan, like wishing for a more hard-edged partisanship in the sense of actually fighting for your own side among the Democrats.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that is like this Reagan-era PTSD that some of these politicians are from, you know, where they are so terrified of making their own case, and they do conflate the ideological with the strategic in that, you know... Me asking Nancy Pelosi to fight Democrats, it has nothing to do with the fact that, you know, I wish Pelosi was further left, right? But I feel like fighting Republicans. Yes, go on, Alex.
Oh no, yeah. I mean, I think it's you know, it's a long hangover from a period of losing over and over and over again, and you know, I don't think like. When you look at there are a lot of structural barriers to Democrats taking and consolidating power. But when you look at just like election results from 2006 through now, this is not a party that should be terrified of being on the wrong side of public opinion.
It's interesting, you know, since we're talking about 15 years ago and what was going on in the blogs at that time, because, you know, I've had this conversation with Heather Parton, who is, you know, one of the original bloggers from that era. She blogs over at Hullabaloo, and the, you know, the Netroots, as it was called at the time, were associated with that type of, it wasn't, I think they were generally slightly to the left of the Democratic Party, but the real complaint was less about ideology and more about partisanship, I think. Yeah. Yeah. And there is also, I will say, an argument too, that part of this lack of partisanship suits an ideology. And this is where things get a little bit nuanced. Atreos, one of those, Duncan Black, one of those original bloggers who blogs over at Eschaton, he had a post the other day I thought was really interesting and completely on point. He writes that the Trump years have taught me that a lot of powerful people in various power tracks don't much believe in the fundamental importance of the consent of the governed. Goes on to say the he goes on to say the that they gazed at the militarized racism of the right and the mild redistributionist social justice warriors, in quotes, left, and declare them to be just the same, both just different flavors of populism, you see, which we know is very bad indeed. And there is a, I think there is a good argument that, and it's, I don't know, it's hard to disaggregate and know, you know, how much of one versus the other. But there is a good argument that part of that the lack of partisanship, even if it's in service of rather, you know, banal democratic, longtime democratic perspectives, is also an invitation for maintaining the status quo in a way that it doesn't make it look like you're fighting for it.
Yeah. I think that you can see that. You can really clearly see that when you get to a more micro level and you look at politics in, you know, you look at the sort of Democrats who are in the New England who are happy to have moderate Republican governors. You look at the sort of Democrats in New York who were happy to have Republican control of the state Senate. And I think what that is they don't want their base to know. They want their base to believe that there are structural impediments to them doing what they claim they were elected to do, or to claim there are structural impediments to doing what their base thinks they were electing them to do. I think it's like it is both a sort of strategic misunderstanding in the sense of like following polls, but it does serve an ideological purpose, which is to say like. Well, you know, we would obviously love to pursue the liberal agenda that we all agree on, but, you know, here's why we can't.
And then that has reverberating effects where you have Democrats who are more committed to process than they are to any ideology, really. Like I saw that in Obama, where it's this fetishization of compromise and process and institutions in a way that you never hear on the right, where they're just basically advocating for themselves in terms of in comparison to Democrats politically, but also in their talking points. And so nobody wants to vote for process. They want to vote for strength. And that consistently puts Democrats at odds with victory.
And to address the counter on that, which is, you know, we need these processes. We don't want Democrats to act like Republicans. You do hit a point where your fealty to process can, and we're, you know, I'm thinking just off the top of my head, Patrick Leahy's fealty to the blue sip process, which prevented many, you know, judges to be filled by Barack Obama. And now to have been filled by Donald Trump in a record-breaking number of appointments to the federal judiciary over the course of 4 years, you do hit a point where your fealty to process can ultimately lead to an inability to even resuscitate that process. In other words, like, you know, at one point, you get enough federal judges up there, your ability to win elections becomes severely diminished. And, you know, we see that in the context of gerrymandering. We see that in the context of, you know, restrictions on voting. This is, and there does not seem to be largely an awareness of this. I mean, I think there is, I mean, you and I have talked about Chuck Schumer quite a bit in the past. This week, we saw Chuck Schumer, respond, or it appears that he responded to the progressive outrage at what Dianne Feinstein did in that last week before the election, where ostensibly there was a sham hearing for Amy Coney Barrett. I say ostensibly because when you walk into a hearing and you act like the hearing is completely normal, and then you finish it by saying, this is the best hearing I've ever been to. Very hard to maintain
that it was a, yeah,
that it was a sham, yeah, right? Exactly. I mean, like, you don't need to be a paid political consultant.
No, this whole court is out of order, but I'm really enjoying myself.
it's even worse than that. This whole court is out of order, but I have to say it has been run in the most judicious manner possible. Yeah.
So much so that I need to give a visual representation via a hug to right. Lindsey Graham, who is, by the way, up for re-election in a race that is supposedly close.
Yeah.
And Chuck Schumer, I want to say to his credit, came about that Feinstein is no longer the, yeah. Now I would have preferred maybe someone like Sheldon Whitehouse as opposed to Dick Durbin, but
right.
With all that said, he's responding. Schumer is responding to the pressure and the growing, burgeoning progressive power in the state of New York.
Yeah,
I don't think he feels like he could lose his election, but I do think he feels like he could. There could be signs of weakness.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why politicians respond to that. And why do you think that is? Like, why do you think losing 30% of the vote would be so problematic for Chuck Schumer in a primary?
I mean, that's a good question. And I think, like, I'm not someone who thinks Schumer is challengeable in a primary. I mean, he's got his claws, you know, in this electorate. But, you know, I feel like we are always using him as a punching bag, but Schumer, I think, thinks of himself as a weather vane. And sometimes the issue is that he's not actually as accurate of a weather vane as he ought to be. But we, you know, you and I know that he thinks, like, I will precisely be in the middle of my caucus. Right. But, you know, the difference between Schumer and Pelosi is Pelosi has been running the House like an autocrat. And you can't, I don't think you can run the Senate. You can't run a Senate caucus that way. So to some degree,
Mitch McConnell seems to have done pretty well.
Actually, I should say I'm completely wrong because McConnell can just do whatever he wants. I think Schumer doesn't want to do it that way. That's probably a better way to put it. Schumer wants to be old fashioned and let, you know, and as much as we complain about him, we have to remember, like, these Democratic senators, they choose him every time. He's not doing any, no strong arm tactics to, like, stay in power.
Well, I think my assessment of Chuck Schumer is, I mean, he is famously had a fictional family on Long Island, the Baileys, whom he would, I guess, go into, you know, in some moment of introspection, would ask himself, what would the Baileys say about this? And I think Chuck Schumer, for a senator, is particularly sensitive to constituent services.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
But and to a fault, I think he perceives his role as leader as providing to constituents in the Senate. And I think, you know, Pelosi has some of this as well, but I think Schumer has it to a fault insofar as he asks nothing of them.
Yes, exactly.
Or extremely, you know, very little. Now, I think this Dianne Feinstein thing, I don't know. I haven't seen any type of, like, internal reporting about what went down. But certainly there was pressure on Schumer and on Feinstein after that whole session.
You had like Democratic senators speaking anonymously to HuffPost questioning her mental acuity. I mean, it was that bad.
It was
senators,
getting,
not
it was
staffers.
Yeah. Now, Nancy Pelosi, I think to the extent that she provides constituent services, it's really more shoring up her power in a rather aggressive way to fend off any type of challenge, et cetera, and does so by, like you say, very autocratic ways. I mean, they weren't having any votes during much of COVID.
Yeah.
They don't allow she for the first time as a party leader said, you cannot subpoena any witnesses unless that subpoena goes through my office. That is unprecedented, as far as I know, in the House. And that inhibits people's ability to hold the people who work for Donald Trump to account. And in my mind, associate them with the Republican Party. That was a real problem, I think, that we had in the election and in elections in general. Let me ask you, talk about another piece that you wrote which is, I guess we've touched on it a little bit, but what if the Democrats' message just doesn't matter? I mean,
yeah.
Tell us about what the argument is there.
So I wrote that one very, very shortly after the election, and I was trying to put together a lot of different strands that in what I heard people sort of talking about and interpreting from the results of the of an election where, you know, obviously Joe Biden won unprecedented turnout, but also disappointing down ballot results. And I mean, people always like to argue, it's a very common joke that after any election or before any election, people will argue, if the Democrats want to win, they should adopt all of my policy preferences or blah, blah, blah. Right. But like, it's also like people will say, why didn't they run on this? Why didn't they run on that? I am coming to believe that because of how the media has fragmented and how people are getting information now, and in part because of how Democrats run campaigns, that to say Joe Biden should have run on this barely matters. And my example I used was the minimum wage ballot vote running way ahead of Biden in Florida. Like 60% or more than 60% of Floridians voted to raise the minimum wage to $15, which was a leading edge sort of progressive wing demand for the last few years. And Joe Biden's been good on the minimum wage.
Yes.
He didn't make it a centerpiece of his campaign, but he said it, you know, he ran on it. He said it on in a debate with Trump. He said, I want to raise the minimum wage to $15. And Trump disagreed with him. And it didn't really come to matter. And I think that you have a lot of voters now who are in a sort of media ecosystem, especially like the more marginal voters, where they do not encounter quote unquote Democratic messaging. And then like when they do, it just makes no difference to them. It's like it might as well just be like it has no sort of connection to what Democrats actually want to do. I think it's like Facebook is a huge part of that, but I think it's a whole lot of other factors.
I mean, but like you say, I mean, Biden said it once on the debate, and I know it was, you know, part of his platform. It was on his website, but he certainly didn't run on that. And I think, you know, I am coming to agree with you that messaging, particularly during elections, because you brought this up multiple times, right? There's been multiple examples of this now over the past couple of cycles where focus groups will Democratic pollsters will sit down with focus groups and say, you know, Paul Ryan wants to cut Social Security and Medicare. And the people in the focus group are like, we don't believe that. That's going to be a Democrat. And I think the problem is that it's very possible that particularly during a campaign, people are not open to these type of messages. And it becomes that much more incumbent upon how you legislate, how you serve when you do have power, that you are doing so in a manner that at the very least creates some definitions between you and your opponents.
Yeah. And I think like a great example of this is that I am now a firm believer that Trump overperformed in large part because of the stimulus, because of the unemployment and because of the stimulus checks. And it's really like one of my arguments was that it's become difficult to convince Americans that if elected, you will make things better. It's just really hard to get anyone to believe that. So your only hope is to like try to win power and then make things better and then try to take credit for it.
Right. I mean, I think that is the only possible explanation as to why Nancy Pelosi did not take the $1.8 trillion Mnuchin and Trump deal. I mean, because even if it was zero, even if there was nothing in that deal, like literally nothing, it would have, at the very least, it would have had the benefit of forcing Mitch McConnell to take a vote he didn't want to take.
Right.
I mean, there was a lot of the reasons why you would accept that, even if you thought it was completely useless. And I don't know how you expend $1.8 trillion, even if it is completely I guess, deployed in such a manner that would help just the very narrow few, you're still stimulating the economy, maybe in a very inefficient way, and you may be enriching people and you may create long-term problems. But right now we have some very, very desperate short-term problems. But I think that is what Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi felt. I think that they were afraid that if they passed that stimulus, that Donald Trump would benefit to the detriment of Joe Biden's campaign. I mean, I don't know if that's true, and there's no way to prove that or not, but it's the only rational explanation.
It's the only explanation that for like, because Pelosi's explanations made less and less sense as the negotiations went on. They really made less and less sense. And I think that's it. And she obviously was not willing to admit.
It became testing and testing infrastructure at the end. I was like, these are the kind of semantics that you would not be obsessed over if it wasn't an election with 2 weeks to go.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you knew that. And the odd thing is, I think that had it passed 2 weeks out, I don't think people would have felt that impact. I think to a certain extent.
Yeah. You could have done it. You could have done it 2 weeks out and it probably wouldn't have made a huge difference.
And worst
case scenario, you put McConnell in a terrible position and the rest of the Republicans.
Yeah. Yes, they didn't want to vote for that. But I do think that, you know, there is a tendency with the Democrats to perceive reality as it is reflected back by some of these so-called moderates and so-called neutral observers in the media, the Washington media. And I do think that is a vestige of a bygone era where, you know, David Broder, who our listeners under the age of 35 have no idea who that person is. But, you know,
he still looms large in the imagination of.
I mean, that is the thing, is that this is a guy who, like, you know, it's just simply a Washington Post columnist, I think it was. Right.
Yeah,
the idea that this guy would have held that type of sway seems unimaginable today. Because I think people under the age of 35, under the age of 40, they have multiple sources of media. But I think we have a generation of Democratic leaders. And I say this is specifically Democrat because how many leaders of the House have we had, of the Republican caucus in the House have we had since Nancy Pelosi became
the leader?
Is it five?
Yeah.
Six? I mean, that's pretty stunning. Now, granted, one or two had to leave because of scandal,
right?
But nevertheless, that's pretty stunning that the Republican Party has that kind of leadership, dynamics, and the Democrats don't.
This connects completely to what we were talking about earlier, which is something that gets mistaken for an ideological dispute about how Democrats campaign, and when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez very famously set off that civil war by talking about these campaigns that didn't do enough digital. I think that there still is a huge, and this is part of the point of my piece about messaging. It's like, there's this big investment in TV ads that I don't believe are persuasive.
Well, it's not designed to be persuasive, right? It's designed to enrich the
consultants.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And like, again, that attack on Ocasio-Cortez's critique was conflated to make it, oh, look at this far left socialist from Queens in the Bronx who's saying we should run on defund the police. Wait, what are you talking about? That's not what it was. It was always, as you mentioned, like strategic in how you go after Republicans independent of policy and like what you're running on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that like this is, you know, I think Democrats need to actually start thinking more about persuasion and how it actually could potentially work. And I think that a sort of campaigns run by sort of nationally focused consultants fixating on TV have shown their limits of their success. And what they actually sort of need to think about is building up parties that have contact with real people in real places that happens year round and not just in election season. And I think they've been.
Well, that's Doug Jones's point. I think.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that radical Doug Jones. Exactly.
Right. Democrats invest in candidates and not in districts. And
yes,
he wants that money to build an infrastructure in these districts so that they exist throughout the years, as opposed to just some resources that come in for a candidate 6 months out before an election. I think that question of tactics and the question of, you know, what Republicans do, they get into power. And one of the first things they do is they work on maintaining their power.
Yeah.
They push, I think it was back in 2008, I guess it was, where every Democrat ran on card check. You had, it didn't start until about June because Al Franken wasn't seated, but then you had a majority in the House. I mean, you had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. You had a majority in the House. You could have passed card check, which would have strengthened unions.
Yep.
And made it easier for the ability of people to unionize. And we know there's a direct correlation between union density and the ability to elect Democrats. Democrats didn't do it. And
one of the most shocking. I mean, there were a lot of missed opportunities from that era. The, you know, doing anything for climate is probably the most impactful. But the card check one is the biggest, like, what the hell? Like, how did you not do it? How did you not do it?
It raises that question. Is it just simply political misfeasance, or is it some type of political malfeasance? Right. How much was it a fear to empower unions versus just a failure to understand the value of empowering unions? All right. Well, listen, we got to take a break. When we come back, Alex, we're going to play a clip because Thanksgiving is, obviously this week. And you may not be aware of this, but the Marxists, there has been a war on Thanksgiving this year. And we think about the war on Christmas, of course, but there's been a war on Thanksgiving. When we come back, we will talk about how that has been taking place at the formerly Trump News Network. We'll be right back. So before we go, Alex, I wanted you to see Fox's Rachel Campos Duffy, who believes that that there is a Marxist conspiracy, apparently of the likes of us are involved with, to inhibit the enjoyment of Thanksgiving. Now, lest you think it's just Fox News, remember, Ted Cruz was sending out memes to this effect. And I'm sure, you know, you may not see the Republican senators do it on Twitter, but you can be sure they're doing it on Parler. But here is Rachel Campos Duffy.
Look, they also turn people, their neighbors in China and in the Soviet Union. This is so un-American. And right now, just keeping your family Thanksgiving tradition right. Seems like an act of civil disobedience. I say, the home is sacred. What we do inside of our homes is our business, and I want the government out of it. And believe me, big government, Marxism, this is the one space they've been trying to penetrate for a long time, which are American families. I can tell you this, Brian, Ainsley, and Steve, Americans care more about their grandmothers and their parents more than the government. They know how to take the right precautions to care for grandma, whether it was, I know people who are self-quarantining ahead of Thanksgiving holidays, they're driving instead of flying. People know how to do this, and they don't need the government or nosy neighbors turning them in.
Yeah, except not.
Right.
What is this? Like, I genuinely doubt that there are neighbors watching with binoculars from next door and turning people in. I don't think that that's a thing.
Of course that's not a thing. But the idea that we know what to do as a country as we close in rapidly on 300,000 deaths, as we have multiple situations around the country where hospitals are overrun, where we have crowded airports Right. Where, you know, like the airlines are going, wait a second, I guess we have to reinstitute some of these flights that we dropped. I mean, she's wrong, but
right.
I mean, she's wrong. But with that said, I know, Alex, how much you really, really despise Thanksgiving, and you have done everything you can.
This is my dream scenario right now, is Americans being unable to celebrate Thanksgiving. I'm looking down on Whoville and I'm laughing that there's no...
Alex, I think you're confusing your war on Christmas with your newly begun war on Thanksgiving. You're mixing up your battle plans.
That's true.
All right. Well, listen, guys, I want to wish both of you a happy Thanksgiving. I hope everybody's the celebration for a lot of people this year has been sort of, truncated, abbreviated, diminished in some way. But the important thing, we stay healthy so that we can have a great Thanksgiving in 2021. Mm-hmm. So enjoy, guys. Thank you so much. And of course, we will be back live on Monday after a couple of days off to sleep off some of that turkey, despite the fact that we're also very busy turning in our neighbors.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks, guys.
All right.
And for those of you who are going to stick around for the fun half, we'll be back in a moment. We just lost Alex. All right. Well, Alex, goodbye. I am already trying to figure out how I can turn in my neighbors and, you know, ruin their Thanksgiving. That's basically
obviously
my bonus.
Yeah. Well, that's the only thing that'll give you joy on Thanksgiving.
Yes, without a doubt. You know what? We're not going to do, we're going to do a freebie Wednesday. And because we're not going to be live Thursday or Friday. I was contemplating maybe doing getting on and just taking phone calls on YouTube, but I have a feeling that's not going to happen. My kids won't allow that on Friday. Let's just take this a moment, Emma, because I think people are dying to know, what is your favorite dish? I want, everybody's got to step up and join in this.
Well, I do believe we discussed this and you really didn't like my favorite dish, but
yeah, it's like you disregarded that answer we already gave.
Yeah,
Oh, your gravy, right?
No, like, no, not gravy. I'm not like drinking gravy through a straw, please.
Mashed potatoes. Yeah, that's why I forgot. I mean, because that's not even it's like saying, I don't know, I like bread.
No, yeah. Well, I love bread.
Well, I know, but that's not bread.
I mean, I heard you react to Brendan's toast this morning, so I don't know why you're slamming bread all
Brendan
of a sudden.
Was really, that was like, that is some hard crusted toast.
That's
speaking
good bread.
Of hard crusty, let's bring Andy Kindler on. Andy Kindler, of course, the famous comedian from, I always forget what the name of that show was. Witches of Waverly Place? Is that what it is? Andy, what's the deal? You won't come on now? He doesn't have a good internet connection.
He just wants us to bask in the display photo.
Is that it?
Here
he is. Just Andy Kindler, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I started to.
He's watching something.
Yeah, what is going on, Andy?
I know what he's watching.
I'm trying to turn off Dennis Miller.
Yeah,
oh, I see.
I was working.
Yeah. God.
Andy, say hi to Emma. Have you met Emma before?
Yes, I met Emma before. I met Emma the night of the, when we thought the election was going to be lost.
Oh, and yeah. Well, that was all a painful blur.
You guys really brought me up that night. I mean, I felt good after that phone call. I defenestrated myself. You can't hear me, right?
Yeah, we can hear you. Will you point your camera down? It's like almost... I don't know. That's a very that means something. You look great. You look great.
Oh, I've had work done.
Oh, really?
Not on my act.
Okay. Now, Andy.
Hi, Emma.
Hey, what's up, Andy?
We have before we get into
Here we go.
Okay. Oh, he wasn't even listening. Andy, before we get into the main course, before we get into the turkey, as it were.
Okay.
I don't know what was starting with like some hors d'oeuvres. I'm not sure what would this be in the.
I don't know why you're using these kind of metaphors now. Is it because you're talking about the reference king? Is it you want to
well,
get?
Well, I'm using these metaphors also because it's like Thanksgiving. It's like our.
Yeah, he's trying to tie in Thanksgiving to the program, right?
I cannot believe it. You guys, I thought would be the last people who would be going with the gimmicky, trendy. What's new for Thanksgiving? Are you doing some kind of
yeah,
a...
Yeah, please don't loop me in with Sam. Like, obviously, I didn't.
I know, yeah. Emma had begin. She was completely... She's completely doing this against her will. She's not... she was not consulted in any way. I'm doing this, like, everything, everything that we reference for the next 30 minutes must be accompanied by a reference to one of the Thanksgiving foods that you enjoy, Andy.
Oh, of course, I got to do it like Dennis Miller. Got the green bean casserole. Beautiful green bean casserole.
I'm getting a telemarketer. It's really hard for me to not answer this.
You get a telemarketer during the show?
Yeah, they get a little phone call from a telemarketer.
Do you not get a bill? I get a million a day, but it's never the fun ones that Sam likes with like a live person on the other end. It's just a robot.
I want the Social Security. Okay, so before we get into
but I will tell you though, Emma, what I am getting now is... from the political things. John Ossoff has jumped off a building. If you don't match,
some really bad email companies. Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah,
Mitch McConnell's punched in the face.
The only thing standing between you and John Ossoff being run over by a truck is $2 from your credit card.
Sometimes it scares me. Sometimes.
So. All right. Well, Andy, let's. I want to shift from this.
How do I look, by the way?
You know, you look great.
I want to shift
to Emma. Will be back in a moment when we get
Emma. You do what you have to do.
She'll be back in a moment. When we get back
to
Dennis
Miller. Following Emma.
But first, we're going to take a little
unfollow and follow people daily
just to get their attention.
Me. No,
what
they don't follow me.
What a power play! Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know, they don't follow me. Oh, she's not following me today. Maybe she'll follow me tomorrow.
Let's see.
I will follow you today, man.
Andy's like a king negger on Twitter, right? Like he's always just like throwing shade at people as a way to get their attention. Andy.
Talk to me.
Have you been blocked by James Woods?
Yeah. No. It's just amazing. He must not see my stuff. Because okay. I go nuts. I mean, I get all the bile. I call him a Nazi. I call him everything he truly is.
He's blocked me. He blocked me a long time ago, and I regret it because I'm not going to have the opportunity to tweet at him about this. This is a scene. Do we know, Brendan, can you give me some background on this? Like when was this movie made? Where was it distributed? Is it one of those things where it's just like, Rudy Giuliani's like cousin made this movie and then they just showed it at like their family reunions or what?
This was a made for TV movie on the US network in 2003 called Rudy Giuliani Story.
Oh this no, like, this can't be true.
Yeah, this is so insane. You know, I read a quote from Atrios, earlier in the program, and he finished it with talking about in it, you know, we lived in such an F up world that David Dinkins passes away, you know, and not many people have given a thought to him, but Rudy Giuliani has maintained his credibility for 20 years and the guy's a lunatic. It's hard for people who are younger than us, Andy, to understand just how deified Rudy Giuliani was. Despite the fact that World Trade 7 had to come down because of all the diesel fuel in that building as a function of him having the command center there instead of Brooklyn. And why did he want it there? It was because he was having an affair and he wanted a crash pad.
My God. Was Bernard Kerik involved in
Kerik,
that?
Kerik had his crash pad at the place that was donated for people working the pile. And that's where he had his affair.
Oh, my God.
Look, I'm not being moral about affairs. People want to have affairs. That's fine. It's just I don't think the taxpayers should support it. And,
no.
I'm one of those guys who's a little bit, I believe in austerity to set up
crash pads. Call me old fashioned.
Exactly.
Make sure the pad where you're having your fare is up to code.
Now, here is a scene from the Rudy Giuliani story. Now, to be honest with you, I don't know who these two people, I know that one of them is supposed to be Rudy Giuliani. It's hard to place who the woman is because James Woods looks so old. It's hard to know how old Rudy Giuliani is supposed to be in this scene. And of course, Rudy Giuliani had so many affairs, I can't keep track of who this is supposed to be. So, but just watch this scene because it's precious.
Much of a cuddler.
No.
I mean, I'm not a fart ass. I'm not insensitive. I mean, for instance, this is
pretty. But it's not for you.
Well, my favorite view of the night sky is over Sheep's Meadow, Central Park.
Oh, thank you. So that's where you want to be.
I told you, New York is me.
So that's the game plan. Not Justice or Washington.
New York can be great again. Someone has to set a high standard. That's what my father told me. Dad, my other heroes. Winston Churchill, Bobby Kennedy.
A Democrat.
As I once was.
Why'd you switch?
You know, Democrats always talked about things getting better. Republicans did whatever they could to make them better.
Oh my God.
That's what I'm here for.
Whoa! Wait, that's what we're here for—to kiss me?
Oh, God!
You know what I have to say? I've always said he was a great actor because he was great in The Onion Field, and I have not changed my opinion in any way.
The Onion Field?
The Onion Field is happens to be an amazing movie. Everybody's seen
it. He's good in Casino too.
But The Onion Field is a famous movie about who? Could someone explain to Sam what The Onion Field is?
I'm pretty sure I saw it. Was it The Onion Field? Okay.
It's that guy who, Joseph Wamba, who wrote about police a lot. He wrote The Onion Field.
Okay.
And it was an amazing movie. And now I can't, now I can't watch.
No, James Woods, he was a good actor.
But what happened to him? He couldn't believe that Rudy Giuliani was an actual person.
I mean, it's stunning. It's stunning just to give you a notion of like where we were with the world. I mean, here, if you want to talk about before we get to the main course.
I'm crying about that. He sounds sad.
I know. We're teasing it. But before we get there, let's look at another actor who also sort of lost his mind years ago, went up to Canada to avoid paying taxes. And this is a Randy Quaid.
I was going to guess it. Everyone knows it's Randy.
Yes, Randy Quaid.
Retweeted by Donald Trump. Yes.
Retweeted by Donald Trump. Quaid, I think, did this like a week or two ago. But it is going to be 6 months from now. There's going to be a huge segment of the population that is just going to be bat crap crazier than they are now. Here's Randy Quaid.
Get some sound.
Brenda's going to work on that sound there. Oh, Andy, what are you doing?
I had to get a tissue.
Oh, all right.
Things have completely. Fox News daytime ratings have completely collapsed. Weekend daytime, even worse. Very sad to watch this happen. But they forgot the win.
Is that Charles Manson?
Yeah.
It's Randy Quaid.
They forgot what made them successful. What got them there. They forgot the golden goose.
Nice special effect.
The only difference between the 2016 election and 2020 is Fox News.
Huh?
Fox News daytime ratings.
I don't really understand. Is he saying, what's he trying to say?
He's trying to say Fox cost Trump the election.
Oh, yep. You should never have predicted him to have won in Arizona.
That's what did it when Fox News called Arizona That is why Donald Trump lost, apparently.
So the president saw that and goes, this seems like an appropriate message to get to the masses. I agree. I love his delivery. You know, it doesn't seem like some crazed guy on the street in New York City at all, right?
Well, I don't think
he's flashing people and port authority.
you have not considered all of the factors. For example, Andy Kindler's Jewish nose. Have you thought of that fact?
It's pretty nuts that that's what the president of the United States is retweeting. I mean,
you think
he saw
that, though? Someone told him about that.
I think he's watching that.
But
I think
that means all we have is Dennis Quaid now. All we have is Dennis Quaid.
And I think Dennis Quaid's also a Trump supporter.
I know, because he goes, here's what he said. He goes, I can't say Trump's doing a good job with the quarantine.
With coronavirus, yeah.
I can't say that. So Dennis Quaid's going, Jesus, people, look how good. He's doing so great. I mean, that's where that's not just your politics that's off.
Yeah, no, I know. I found out about his politics by my heartbroken mother.
I know, because he's a great. I used to love him in that Bonnie Raitt video.
I don't remember that, but
yes, you do. I'm older than you, Sam. Just face it. I'm a little.
Which
old.
One? The I can't make you love
just,
me.
Just give me something to talk about.
He's in that.
Yes, he's dancing. Bonnie Raitt playing.
What was the movie that he was in with
The Parent Trap?
He was great in Postcards from the Edge. He was also good in that.
I'm thinking about the one with Nicholson where he is a Navy guy. I can't remember who the third guy was in it. It's a great movie.
Tom Cruise?
No.
It's not years ago. Men.
Old movie. I can't remember what the something. I can't remember what the movie is, but it's a great movie.
An old movie, like when I was 40, it came out.
When you and I, yeah, would see when we were
the last detail.
Last detail.
Oh, that's the Randy Quaid movie. That is one of the best movies ever made.
That's one of the best movies ever.
Oh, yes.
Al Ashby.
Yes.
Yeah. Drop your socks, and yeah, that was his first. Maybe not his first movie, but
I think it was.
He
was a young
unbelievable.
Guy. Yep.
Emma, you have to see The Last Detail. If you see no other Jack Nicholson movie today.
All right. Now, Andy,
well, I was thinking of watching About Schmidt, but maybe not.
We don't have too much time.
I love About Schmidt.
We got to get to this. We got to get to this.
Okay. Am I being made fun of because I like About Schmidt?
No. I've been on a Alexander Payne kick, and that was going to be
You'll love that
one.
Movie. In okay. Goo Goo. All right. Sorry.
Wow. You're like an encyclopedia, like a Andy film guy.
I enjoy watching people on the screen.
Now, listen. I want us to be a little bit somber and have a little reverence because this could be the last time we ever do this if we are to believe what Dennis Miller is saying. Now, Dennis Miller virtually has disappeared from social media. He put out a podcast shortly after the election. And, you know, we've been down this road before. Remember where he said, like, I'm not going to be talking about politics anymore. And then he started talking about politics again. And then he said, I'm not going to be talking about politics anymore. And they started talking about politics again. And then, you know, Bill O'Reilly got fired and he started to go on other shows and he just couldn't find the same chemistry with Lou Dobbs or whoever it was. I mean, it's tough.
Not
easy to have chemistry with Lou Dobbs, I'd agree.
Let's just start with this clip. Let's start at this clip number one, 538.
Martin and Louis Dobbs. Sorry.
This is heartbreaking. Let's listen to this. Dennis Miller's...
He's so handsome. He is.
And I understand he charges 30 pieces of silver for the interview.
That's very good.
I don't even know what to talk about anymore. We're in the last few podcasts, folks, so hang in there. And I'm trying to figure out what to talk about. One of the reasons I'm leaving is I don't want to be called in front of now that the loving people have taken over the country, I cannot bring myself to show up at a reconciliation panel and explain my beliefs that don't commingle, you know, with Deborah Messing's. So I'm checking out, and if you notice the conversation's tepid over the next few weeks, I'm done with American politics and current events.
I did get a couple
notes
from people.
Let's just pause it right there. I just, you know, the idea, like, of all the people that you would invite to a reconciliation panel,
right,
there is no doubt in my mind that people would completely leave him off the list. Like just a, not even like we shouldn't bring in Dennis Miller. He was a good, it was just like Dennis Miller. It never even occurred to me. What?
Right. Yeah.
And Deborah Messing too. Like, why are these two non-actor?
That's what American politics are.
Yeah. Don't we have more current references who are at the reconciliation meeting? There's got to be a more current crop. This is like me. If I was going to a reconciliation meeting with my old style, with Paul Lynn would be there. I mean, he's got to.
This is like 12 Angry Men. And
what is he reconciling?
Well, he's saying that now that Joe Biden, the avowed social justice warrior
but somehow still also communist, authored the crime bill and is very bad for that was my favorite line that Trump tried to walk in the campaign. Like, he wrote the crime bill and he locked up all these black people, but also he loves riots and crime.
But he is going to hold apparently show trials for Hollywood comedians who have been primarily making their living appearing on a Bill O'Reilly show until it got canceled.
That's what he said
and
about
call him up. The idea that how centered has this guy put himself that he is going to have to account for himself? Like, he hasn't had to account for himself for 12 years. We're the only people keeping him alive.
That's right. Yeah. I like the way he goes, I don't know what to talk about. As if anyone is listening to the last few podcasts of his horrible show. You know, I've got a couple of weeks left, and I'm afraid I'm going to be a little tepid. Tepid's a word that makes you seem like you're slightly more intelligent than just saying lukewarm.
What was the name of the show? Is it the Dennis Miller option? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, because apparently what happened is it's like it became the Dennis Miller opt-out, and not many people bothered to listen to the show.
Or they took the other option, right?
That's right.
They went, there was the red pill and then there's the blue pill, and like the blue pill sold out.
Let's go to this one at 8:30. This is where
I'd watch really, Dave Rubin over Dennis Miller.
This is, well, you're going to have to now.
Yeah, that says a lot.
This is where, I don't know. Should we listen to 7:30? Is he getting canceled? Let's listen to this.
He's going on
wherever
his
you think,
own,
Brendan.
Think.
Go one of whichever one of these you think is better.
Getting rid of my social media.
Well, take care of it. So you're acting like I could track this down. To me, folks, it's not worth it anymore. Everybody enjoy their life. I would say live your life inside out. I would say don't pay attention to the country as it's currently constituted. I'd say watch myself. I'd say if anybody asked you what your beliefs are on things, only a certain type of person would ask that, and only a certain type of answer would be desired. And you should just figure out what they want you to say and say it, and then go about your life. Oh. And certainly a podcast doesn't lend itself to that. So I am out of here soon. And
I couldn't even make it through
trying to figure out how we
do believe we'll be able to let.
Yeah. I love how he conflates, as conservatives love to do, consequences for horrible politics with actual persecution.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to say anything that doesn't conform with what other people say, or they're going to say, I disagree with you.
Yeah. And, next time someone says, hey, what do you think about people being ripped from their mothers? You know, don't tell them what you don't. I know you could tell them off if you wanted to. You know, it's like, what does he think is?
Is he implying
is
that
argument?
He's been fired from his podcast because he's been saying things that are too controversial? Yeah, there's no place in there is no opportunity. He's like the intellectual dark web. Like, yeah, there's no place to say anything controversial. Like you cannot, he wouldn't be able to set up his own YouTube channel. I've been shut out. This is, they conflate like the idea of like, there is no audience for my garbage. Therefore, my constitutional rights have been inhibited.
But he's been, and the thing is, he's a person who's been around, like you've been around comedians. He has to know that what he's saying, this is where I'm wrong though. I think he has to know what he's saying is complete garbage, but I don't think so. I think he makes himself get depressed. He pretends to be depressed, so he doesn't actually have to think. It's because he actually thought about the fact that he just sold a $129 million property up in Santa Barbara and that he's never had a thing to worry about in his life. It's his opinions that make him disgusting, and he doesn't want to face it, but he doesn't think that deeply about that.
I'm completely oppressed. I only got $129 million. That's the thing. When I sold my old Subaru, I only got $3,200 for it, and that was because I'm oppressed. I should have gotten. It was a 2002, but I should have gotten like $17,000 for it.
They're always saying the right wing people. Oh, we can't have our opinions. Because they want to be able to say, hey, does everybody agree that we should rip babies from their mothers at the border? That's cool, right? I mean, what are these libs complaining about? What is he thinking that he's going to bring up that he would be afraid to bring up that wouldn't be just a horrible thing?
Well, right? I mean, they always go after the left and say, oh, you know, they're victims. Like, they don't want to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and participate in society. When literally all these conservatives want to do is feel victimized and feel sorry for themselves and feel like they are besieged and besotten and forgotten or whatever, you know, like that's what he's cosplaying as.
What's also stunning about it is for years, we heard the right complain about the left's moral relativism, right?
That
there's that, like, they don't accept that there's an objective truth. And then when the left dares to say, like, hey, we have some standards that if you cross the line of these standards, we're going to be critical of you. And we may not pay you to entertain us anymore because we don't find it entertaining. Then all of a sudden it is like the Constitution's being burned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that's like the thing. It's like, thank God there's people like Reverend William Barber and people who are who are bringing Christianity, who know what Christianity should be about, you know? And it's like, these people are the moral, the right wing, or whatever they were called first, the Christian right. As soon as that happened, that was such a hard, you know, you let so many people in who were just, like evangelist, how can you be an evangelist and claim to be an evangelist and believe in Christ and support anything? These people are phony Christians, you know?
Well, I mean, I say I leave that unto, you know, the Pope or your reverend or pastor. I'm not going to pass judgment on people's Christianity.
I will.
It's not even Christianity. They're just using it. They go, I'm a Christian. Yeah. But then it's like Pompeo. Pompeo is an Islamophobic.
Yes, he
hates Muslims.
Yes.
I mean, I think he said that.
Let's listen to this. This is sort of amazing, right? Like, Miller is going to claim that he's going to go Galt. John Galt, the character from Ayn Rand's,
which I still haven't read.
Is it from Fountainhead?
Could be Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah, who owned like an iron foundry or something.
Yeah. Now, this is what's fascinating, right? In other words, I'm going to be like a market fundamentalist. But here he is. This is the juxtaposition of these two clips are awesome. Here is the first one. This is number 58.
Crazy triptych down. And she's written her memoirs. Found him a little narcissistic, but at least provocative, I find. So that was a 600-page book. Reading about Julius Caesar and reading about Sri Lanka.
Pause it for 1 second.
For a while.
This is a case of the narcissist calling the kettle black, but go ahead.
600-page book.
And I have not paid attention to the news. So when she says Gavin Newsom has issued some mandates about Thanksgiving, I don't know what she speaks. I'm not posing this. I've made a commitment to myself. I'm out. I'm shrugging. I've always been fascinated by John Galt and that concept, and I am going to do it here. And that's part of why the podcast will be going away in a couple weeks. That's why social media has been shut down. I am not going to lead some Ted Kaczynski and, you know, me sitting in a fucking photo hut out on a tundra not paying attention to anything. I'm going to read great literature. I'm going to try to travel a little more, and I'm going to stay away from the news because it's not good. And to me, the state of the world, the country, it's not in good shape. And therefore, I want to love the people I love. I want to eat the foods I want. I want to see places that I want to see. And as I said, I think there's something noble enough about hiking and reading some great literature.
Oh, it's so noble of you to stop doing your podcast. Christy
and Lindsay, and I'll be friends with both of them for my entire life. You can't say anything on the podcast anymore. So I'm choosing not to do the
podcast. Take Kaczynski out of your mouth.
Wait.
Ed Kaczynski was entertaining.
No. He is a regular Henry David Thoreau. I mean, he is the modern day philosopher going into the woods, doing some hiking, some traveling. He's going to read some literature.
Well, but let me ask you this. How do you reconcile the idea of, like, I'm giving up the podcast, and then he's like, you can't say anything on the podcast anymore. Like, who says he can't say anything? Like, what's going on? Like, who is it that's putting out his podcast? They do all sorts of right-wing podcasts.
Yeah,
but apparently he can't say anything. Wait, let's continue.
Steve Bannon has a podcast.
Of course. Like, I think you can say anything on a podcast, actually. I'm quite convinced that you could say anything on a podcast.
And Ted Kaczynski is so much more entertaining than he will ever be in a million years.
All right,
and
let's run through.
And smarter.
Yeah. Because
Ted Kaczynski is...
I'd rather go to a dinner party with Ted Kaczynski.
40 seconds away from him giving up the ghost here. You can't say anything on a podcast. I'm giving up the podcast. These things don't necessarily add up. Well, let's continue.
I'm feeling it's unbecoming to continually whine about something as you're approaching your 70th year.
Not
do anything about it.
And that's
what I'm going to do is shrug and drop out. And
shrimp?
I think you understand.
Shrug.
And live your life inside out. Now, I'll leave it at that because I don't want to get maudlin about it. But I've enjoyed my time here, and I've enjoyed the podcast, but time to go.
We've
got a few more left. So I'm explaining that to you so we can get on from here and just do normal podcasts for the rest of the time, and you'll know that I did speak to it at some point because I don't want that that last one to be so...
You know what this has nothing to do with?
Another podcast has bit the dust.
I'm still laughing at my own material.
Radio show where I got a call on a Thursday afternoon, and it said, "So you did your last show this morning." I'm like, "Wait, what now?
What?"
You know, you mix into it that nobody's listening to the podcast. So you know, when I'm
selling,
you
know,
you guys
That's
are brilliant.
It.
You know,
and we're out.
There we go. That's it. That's all, folks. I mean, that's the whole point. Like, you get to act like you're persecuted and that you're canceling your podcast because no one wants, you know, to hear your high-level conservative ideas, but it's because no one's listening. Oh. If you were very profitable in this podcast, Dennis, I don't think you would be.
Do you know how much his constitutional rights are being abridged by people not listening to his show?
It's hard for me to fathom, but I think the founders would have had a fit with this.
Well, you should listen to the ads he's doing on this show because he's even less connected to the things. Yeah, get smart mouth mints. Yeah, smart mouth mints. Yeah, do you have a smart mouth? Then go with the smart mouth mints. He has... I can't believe now that he ever was anywhere. He's really ruined everything.
Well, he's going to go Galt. And but the next two podcasts are just going to be normal podcasts that nobody's going to listen to. I wonder
so fascinating, you know.
How much money do you think? I mean, how much money do you think he must have been paid up front to do these podcasts? Because if it was just him doing the podcast and he didn't owe a couple more shows, he'd just go.
Right.
Right? No, but instead he's gotta fulfill his contract. So you know he got paid maybe tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars up front. Nobody listened.
I don't want to think about that.
Nobody listened. So they said, "Hey, we're going to have to wrap this up. Do you want to buy out?" And he's like, "I'm not taking a buyout. I'll just do the rest of the shows. You're not going to pay off my contract for less. I'm doing the rest of the shows. You're going to pay me. I'm going Galt." And he didn't, but then he blames the audience for, "You can't say anything. You know, you can say whatever you want. It's just that people aren't forced to listen to bad content."
Right. What happened to free market, bro? Like, aren't you all about that? No. He wants his podcast socialized.
I'm the John Galt that insists that people pay for my podcast, and even though they don't like it.
That sounds like socialism to me. I don't know.
Just to fill in the plot, John Galt created a motor that ran on like static electricity, basically like a free energy machine. I don't think Dennis's jokes are quite that.
Yeah. No, he was the first one to get paid that much money for a podcast that has no listeners, except for people who are making
laughs. On a static audio.
You got to go.
I have a hard. I'm going to do therapy in one minute.
Andy's got a hard out. Andy,
thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Andy. See you soon.
I miss you guys so much.
Love you too.
Love you too.
Can't wait to do this in studio someday.
Oh yes,
we'll make it. We'll make it. Bye, Andy. Andy Kindler, ladies and gentlemen.
The man.
The man. The legend. So, Emma.
Yes.
I will see you, I guess, on Monday. We will be in studio together, and it will be we'll be talking, I imagine, about the potential for a government shutdown. We will, I would imagine, over the coming weeks, we're going to be talking more about Georgia, but I think the people in Georgia, the Ossoff and Warnock, are studiously trying to keep it local. I think they don't want to nationalize this race. I think that's in part of what we've been talking about. The Democrats' national brand, not necessarily great, and not particularly great, obviously, in a state that has been solidly red for years and years. Hopefully that'll change. And we will be talking, undoubtedly, there'll be new cabinet appointees that we can rail on or rejoice in. I would imagine we're going to be
somewhere in the middle, probably. Sometimes most likely in the middle. For, yeah.
Who knows? And, you know, we'll start to, I feel like this period of time between the election and Thanksgiving has been really unsettled. It's tough to know like what we're doing on some level, because
yeah,
so much of this is sort of like weirdly up in the air.
Well, I mean, are we going to talk about COVID? Are we going to talk about cabinet appointees? Are we going to talk about Trump, you know, flailing around? There's just so much, like, there's not a direct focus of what, once Biden's in office, I feel like our direction is going to be a lot clearer, you know?
Well, and the flailing around, there was this quality of like, and we talked about it today with Perrine, but it's flailing around, but it's also like,
okay, setting up this infrastructure that could be really dangerous going forward.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, there's a, it's like a live, like, or a wire that is like flailing around on the ground after a windstorm. And you're just not sure. It's like, hey, is that the fiber? Is that the cable, coaxial cable, or is that the electricity? And yeah. You just don't know.
I think it's just a random cable, but also it could set a spark off and burn the whole house.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, is it a hot wire, or is it just like a wire that's there that's no problem? And I don't know if I want to go up and touch it. So let's just sit here and we'll talk about how it's dancing around. Just wait and see if it's actually got electricity going through it and we're all going to get electrocuted. But fortunately, we didn't, but I don't think that's the end of the story. I do really think that, like,
I mean, the reverberating factors of an entire faction of the country, like a third, truly believing that the elections are unfair and stolen and China and whatever,
I think that's very problematic.
Damage.
And I also think that, like, next time this goes down, people will instinctively not take it seriously, and it could be a lot more serious. But with that ominous message, I wish I had like a thunder on my thing. I just have to do this. Emma, have a great Thanksgiving. Matt,
you too.
Have a great Thanksgiving. Brendan, have a great Thanksgiving. Jamie, if you're out there, have a great Thanksgiving. I think she's already started to celebrate. We will see you live on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. It's still the truth.